Morning, counsel.
Good morning.
May I proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. To please the court, Raymond Radulski on behalf of the appellant cross-appellee Empire Financial Services, Inc. With me at counsel table is David Statz, Esquire. The most immediate substantive issue in this case can be framed by reference to a simple hypothetical. The student might have a brief due in this court in 30 days. I hire a freelance law clerk to draft that brief. I give him the statement of facts. I tell him I will pay you $5,000 in 30 days when you deliver that brief. I reserve the right to withdraw that assignment at any time prior to the 30 days. I also reserve the right to review your work in progress while you're completing that brief. Sometime toward the end of the 30-day period of time, I conspire with the law clerk's roommate. I tell the law clerk's roommate, you deliver the brief to me that's completed, I will give you $2,500. Thereafter, after making that agreement with the law clerk, I contact the law clerk and say, your services are no longer required. The question raised by that hypothetical is, what is the law clerk's measure of damages? Is it the value of the stolen paper? Is it the value of the law clerk's notes, research, and drafts, which obviously are valueless to anyone who doesn't have this brief due in this court? Or is it the law clerk's lost economic opportunity that he lost as a consequence of a theft and a conspiracy? Don't the circumstances of this particular example show my overreaching and undue interference in the law clerk's performance, which negate the exercise of that express contractual power? That's what happened in this case. Change the parties, change the agreement to involve the collection of credit card accounts as opposed to the production of a brief, change the extent of the damages to make them substantially more. That's what happened in this case. In January 1997, a disloyal corporate officer of Empire Financial Services stole thousands of pages of computerized collection notes from Empire in furtherance of a conspiracy that involved the agreement to transfer the accounts that Empire had been servicing for the Bank of New York to the disloyal corporate officer's new agency, DBA Administrative Services. Empire had been collecting these accounts for the prior decade for the Bank of New York, and in the course of doing so, Bank of New York developed into its largest customer, and over $2 million worth of paying and legal accounts had been developed. Paying accounts are those in which the Empire, through its effort and expense, had reached an agreement with the debtors to pay monthly installments on those accounts. Legal accounts were those in which the debtor did not reach an agreement with Empire to pay on the accounts, but the debtor had assets or wages and such that the matter was referred to outside counsel for collection, generally in the form of a judgment and so forth. During the course of this representation or relationship between Empire and the Bank of New York, Empire had developed itself into the number one secondary collection agency for the Bank of New York. Prior to the time incidents in question, the bank had never withdrawn a paying or legal account from Empire, except in an unusual circumstance where it was found that the debtor was a relative or neighbor of one of the high-ranking bank officials. And then it was done simply to avoid embarrassment. The importance of the collector notes stolen by Mr. Acasio from Empire was that they basically contained a work history of every single account. Yes, Ron.
If I'm not mistaken, the question of damages is pretty critical to the appeal. Am I right?
Absolutely, Ron.
Okay. And the trial court said, even though there was a verdict finding a civil conspiracy, that the damages were zero.
Exactly.
Correct?
And the jury had found that Empire had been damaged.
Okay. What I would like you to explain to me is what you claim your damages are and how you determine them.
Your Honor, our damages are the lost economic opportunity that Empire would have had the accounts remained in Empire.
And how is that going to be determined?
That would be determined, Your Honor. We had submitted an expert's report. Basically, the expert had taken the total amount of outstanding paying and legal accounts, had examined to some extent the historical returns, if you will, that would have been available on paying illegal accounts and basically projected those out.
For essentially, how long? Forever?
Well, Your Honor, the bank, as of 2004, the bank, I believe it was a limited period of time in which it was projected out, perhaps maybe 4 years or something like that, if my recollection serves me correct. As of 2004, and these accounts were the information was stolen back in 1997, the bank was still receiving payments on accounts that had been withdrawn. What happened is Mr. Cassio serviced those accounts for some period of time. I think eventually he didn't live up to his obligations with the bank. They took the accounts back from him, and to a large extent, the bank simply retained the accounts themselves, certainly the legal accounts.
But getting back to the damages issue, what you're saying, if I understand, is that although you had a contract that allowed the bank to terminate the relationship pretty much whenever it wanted.
Arguably.
Right. That your position is that but for this wrongful conduct, the bank would have continued using Empire because they had a good and long-term working relationship, and that therefore there should be an assumption that that relationship would have continued, and you're saying for 4 years?
I think we probably arbitrarily picked the four-year period of time, probably looking at the history and as to how long it would take people to pay off accounts and so forth. Some people would take longer, obviously.
And that you should be, your company should, your client should be entitled to the lost profits that it would have made during that continued relationship if it had continued?
The lost economic opportunity. I'm not sure if it would necessarily would focus on profits or not, but clearly they were, all the investment in sweat and effort went up front into the paying illegal accounts. That's where the people were tracked down. When the information would come to Empire, it would be relatively minimal. They might have a bad address. They might not know where the person lived.
Let's assume we understand all that is your client's position. What did the trial judge get wrong when she concluded that the only thing that happened here was the bank facilitated what turned out to be illegal conduct, but there's no indication the bank was even aware of the illegal conduct, and that the contract between bank and Empire basically established a window of 7 days of damages? Where did she get that wrong?
Where she got it wrong, Your Honor, is that, in fact, the jury held that they answered three interrogatory questions. Number one, before Cassio left, did he and the bank reach an agreement about what would happen with the accounts? Answer, yes. Question number two, did the agreement involve the commission of an illegal or improper act? Yes. Number three, was Empire damaged? Yes. So the trial court got that wrong and simply misstated a fact in evidence by the jury, or found by the jury to be a fact in the case, and stated that there's no evidence that the bank was aware of the illegal conduct. In point of fact, they were.
Can I get back to the damages thing, because I'm still not through trying to understand that. I think I do understand what your position is, that you should get these expectation damages looking forward. And not limited to 7 days. What I would like to know is what the authority you have for asserting that position. What is the basis for being able to claim that those damages?
The basis for the position is, absent the tortious conduct or the civil conspiracy, we should be put in the place we would have been put in but for the tortious conduct.
And is there case law to support that?
Your Honor, we would submit that that's the general proposition of law, but specific case law, I would point the court to Justice Ridgely's decision in Anderson v. Airco. Justice Ridgely there discussed the concept of civil conspiracy, basically indicated that the purpose of a civil conspiracy, number one, is to enlarge the numbers of people that are responsible for the conduct, but number two, to increase the measure of damages. That can only mean one thing, is that you basically look at the conduct as a whole. We maintain that the objective of the conspiracy was not simply to have Mr. Cassio steal paper from Empire, which is essentially what the trial court held. The objective of the conspiracy was to move the accounts, coupled with the theft of information which would be utilized to service those accounts. The movement of the accounts was not economical absent the conspiracy and the theft.
Okay,
if the bank had withdrawn those accounts.
Stop. Was the jury asked to decide that question, whether the conspiracy involved more than just the theft of those documents, but also involved the moving of the account unlawfully?
Well, the three questions that were asked, did they reach an agreement about what would happen with the accounts? That's the way the question was posed by the court. Did this agreement involve the commission of an illegal improper act? Yes. That's what specifically the jury was asked. There were lots of torts that the jury could have focused upon. I mean, Ocasio was a disloyal corporate officer stealing from his
whose torts? Cashews or the banks?
Well, Ocasio is in the banks by implication. Conspirators are jointly and severally liable for the actions of their co-conspirators. Once you get on the train, you're responsible for what happens on the train under a conspiracy theory, and I believe that's good law here in Delaware.
Mr. Verdusky, let's go back for a moment to the formation of this conspiracy. This issue isn't really addressed in the briefs, but does the record show whether or not Ocasio was subject to a non-compete agreement if he left Empire?
I don't believe the evidence showed that, Your Honor.
So he was free to go out and compete?
Certainly. Absolutely.
But he wasn't free to take proprietary information.
He printed out about two banker's boxes full of computerized collection notes surreptitiously 2 days before he supposedly reached his agreement.
All right. Okay. If, under those circumstances, if Ocasio then met with Armitage from Bank of New York and said, look, I'm planning to start up my own shop, would you be interested in transferring your accounts from Empire to me? And the bank said yes, and there was no other information given to the bank. Would that be tortious?
Of course not. But that's not what the jury held.
Well, did the jury find, is there anywhere in the record where we can pinpoint that the jury found that the bank knew that as part of his departure and formation of his own competing company, that Ocasio would be taking proprietary information that belonged to Empire?
The jury found that before he left, they reached an agreement about what would happen with the accounts was the first question. The second question was the agreement included the commission of an illegal or improper act.
I know that's what it says, but let's put some flesh on that skeleton, okay? Is there any evidence, and was it argued to the jury, that the bank knew as a result of its meetings with Ocasio, that Ocasio was going to be taking with him records that he shouldn't have been taking?
The timeline showed it, Your Honor. What happened was this. They reached an agreement, and there was documentation in the record to support it. Ocasio testified that he met with Armistead. Armistead said they had a telephone conversation on the 29th, which was a Wednesday. That was supposedly the first time that Ocasio advised Armistead that he was going to be leaving Empire. Ocasio testified subsequently that, yes, I had an understanding I was going to get the accounts at that time.
That still doesn't answer my question.
If the court will bear with me, on the 27th and 20th, supposedly this meeting happened on the 29th. There was a letter dated the 29th, not delivered until the February 3rd, where Armistead sent a letter to Ocasio in his capacity as president of Empire saying, look, we're withdrawing our accounts. We're going to pursue another course of action with respect to secondary accounts. That letter was dated the 29th. Ocasio had gone to the trouble on the 27th and 28th of printing out the 2,000 pages worth of documents that we're talking about in this particular case, that the collector's notes that were of necessity in order to collect on these accounts. He also, on the 28th, printed out an inventory which Armistead did not request until his letter of the 29th. We think there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury. And plus the timing of what happened, Ocasio almost immediately started contacting the attorneys for Empire, who had been collecting for Empire, and advising them, remit the monies to me, not to Empire.
Why would the bank have an interest?
Why?
In Ocasio purloining these documents. All it needed to do was to tell Empire to transfer the documents to Ocasio's company.
Empire was not required to do that. On a recall of accounts under the contract, they were entitled to four pieces of information back: the name, the account number, the status, and the current balance. That's all they were entitled to under the contract. That was work product that they had absolutely no entitlement to.
Right.
And Acacio, also another reason for doing that, Your Honor, is that
Stop.
They were getting a higher
Stop.
Percentage. I'm sorry.
I want to follow up with one more question that Justice Berger's concern about the measure of damages. Well, you're not looking for lost profits. You're looking for lost economic opportunity. What does that mean? I mean, translate that into a formula that leads to dollars.
The economic opportunity is the money we would have earned, and it may be, or it would be lost profits, Your Honor. I'm not sure. It's the money we would have earned had the accounts remained. These accounts had been developed to the point where they only needed
okay.
to be serviced by one person.
Thank you. Lastly, if that was what you're developing, which might be lost profits, certainly some lost revenue, less whatever the expenses would be of generating that revenue, you had ample opportunity to make that of record during the pretrial phase of the case, and yet you did not do that, which led to the Superior Court's finding, entering judgment for zero damages.
No, excuse me, if I could explain, Your Honor, what happened. The court, because the trial court did not allow us to do discovery on what happened to the accounts from the bank, the trial court only permitted a sample of six accounts prior to the liability trial. It was maybe a week or two before trial. The trial court came back and said, look, it's not fair to require you to prove damages when we haven't given you access to what the bank received from those accounts. That's why the trial court bifurcated the trial. We only went to trial on liability.
Well, the question is directed to what happened at the conference memorialized in the trial judge's letter after the liability trial as she was poised to go to the second stage on damages.
What she had done, Your Honor, is she had granted their motion for summary judgment on damages and basically came back and said, you can't recover lost profits. You can't recover lost revenues. You're limited to what you're limited to under the contract, which is 7 days' worth of receipts. So she had foreclosed our opportunity to present that issue to the jury, what we properly believe to be the measure of damages. We submit that it was a factual question, and we should have been able to present it to the jury, and the bank should have been required to make their defense that we're not liable beyond 7 business days. We think that's a factual issue that the court got wrong.
Why would a determination of the extent of damages to which you would be entitled that's governed by contract be a factual issue for the jury?
Because
a legal ruling by her that the contract limited recovery?
She did make that ruling. We don't believe that, first off, we believe the contract language itself is ambiguous, that it doesn't say what the bank even says it says. A fair reading of it was very poorly drafted, and it doesn't say what the bank has asserted it says.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Duncan Grant on behalf of the Bank of New York, Delaware. I have reserved 2 minutes of rebuttal to discuss issues on my cross appeal. Unless the court would like to move me in a different direction during my presentation, I propose to talk about three issues. First, our cross appeal. Secondly, the summary judgment ruling on damages. And third, the $0 ruling by Judge Del Pesco. With respect to the cross appeal, we've raised the question whether the summary judgment record was sufficient for a plaintiff to show that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether an agreement had ever been reached between Ocasio and the bank officer, Armistead. The briefs include the questions and answers during two separate sessions, a private meeting between my friend on the other side and Mr. Ocasio, which resulted in a transcript, and then 13 days later, a deposition that I took of Mr. Ocasio. Within those questions and answers, there is one question and answer which arguably supports the proposition that an agreement was ever reached, which is Mr. Radulski during the private session with Mr. Ocasio asking whether there was any agreement as to which accounts would be moved over to the new agency. Answer, it was my understanding, Mr. Ocasio said, my understanding, he did not say our understanding, that we were going to get everything that was pulled from Empire Financial Services. Our proposition is that that question and answer, which stand alone in supporting the submission by Empire that an agreement was ever reached, is insufficient to establish a genuine issue of material fact, especially considering that the next two answers given immediately after that answer contradicted Empire's position, given the proposition that in my questioning of Mr. Ocasio during his deposition, he flat out said, it would not have been a breach of promise if the bank had not sent its accounts over, the bank had made no commitment. So I think the question for the court on our cross appeal is whether that one question and answer that I've highlighted is merely, as we say, a scintilla, to use the summary judgment vocabulary, and not adequate to create a genuine issue, or alternatively, does it create a genuine issue? We think it does not. Now, moving to the damages issues, the tort that was found by the jury was civil conspiracy. There are three elements of civil conspiracy. One is an agreement. Two is a wrongful objective to the agreement. And three is an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. I've just talked about the agreement element. But let's move to the objective of the conspiracy. Empire's position is that the objective of the conspiracy was to move the bank's accounts from Empire to the new collection agency. We know that for at least two reasons. First, Empire said so in answer to our interrogatory 29. Empire said there that the bank officer, Armistead, agreed with Ocasio prior to Ocasio's departure from Empire that defendants would recall and assign paying and legal accounts being serviced by Empire to the new agency in exchange for consideration beyond that to which the bank would otherwise have been entitled. So they say in their interrogatory answer, the objective is to move the accounts. Mr. Radulski said the same thing at the oral argument before the Superior Court on our summary judgment motion on March 14th, 2005, on page A130 of the Empire Appendix, where he said the objective of the conspiracy, I'm now paraphrasing, not quoting, was to recall the accounts and transfer them to the new agency. Now, that objective, we submit, was not a wrongful objective. The contract absolutely permitted the bank to terminate the contract and move the accounts to any collection agency it wanted or to no collection agency. The accounts belonged to the bank. But now let's move to the third element of civil conspiracy, the overt act, in furtherance of the conspiracy. Empire identified the overt act as Ocasio's theft of Empire documents. In its briefs before this court, Empire says that there were other overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. It refers to conversion, tortious interference, breach of fiduciary duty, misappropriation of business opportunity, misappropriation of trade secrets, commercial defamation. The briefs in this court are the first time that Empire ever suggested that any of those acts were an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. Again, in the same interrogatory answer, our interrogatory 29, Empire said straight up that the overt act was that Ocasio stole from Empire confidential proprietary information which would enable Ocasio and his new agency to service accounts which had been serviced by Empire. And once again, in an oral argument, this was during the trial at the close of Empire's case, we moved for a dismissal under Rule 50. Mr. Radulski, in opposition to that motion at trial, agreed with the court that the improper conduct that gives rise to the whole dispute is the removal of documents that didn't belong to the new agency. That's on page A503 of the appendix. So our submission to you is that the only overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy that Empire has ever identified or relied upon was the theft of the documents by Ocasio. And why is that important? It's important because of the way that civil conspiracy law defines the proper measure of damages. And Justice Berger, I think this goes partly to your questions to Mr. Wadulski. Under the law of civil conspiracy, the damages to which a plaintiff is entitled are those that flow from a tortious or wrongful act in furtherance of the conspiracy. The conspiracy itself is not a basis for a measure of damages or for damages to the plaintiff. There is no case law of which I'm aware, none cited by Empire, to contradict what I just told you the law is. Anderson versus Airco, which Justice Ridgely decided by designation as a Superior Court judge, says an actionable tort must accompany any conspiracy in order for there to be a recovery. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case called Beck versus Prupus, which we cite in our briefs. It's a civil RICO case, but it talks about common law civil conspiracy. In that case, which was a 7-2 decision, the court says that by the time of RICO's enactment in 1970, it was widely accepted that a plaintiff could bring suit for civil conspiracy only if he had been injured by an act that was itself tortious. The court cited its own decision from 1861. It cited 11 state and federal court decisions, two treatises, the Restatement and Prosser, two law dictionary, Ballantine's and Black's, in support of that proposition. And there is no case law, as I say, that I'm aware of which contradicts that. So the question then is, what harm flowed from the underlying tortious act in furtherance of the conspiracy in the framework of what I said a moment ago, which is that the overt tortious act identified by Empire is the theft of the documents? And the way you analyze that, we submit, is that you look at the contract, which says the bank may terminate the relationship on 7 days' notice.
Let me stop you there. This may be a little bit far afield, but I think the case was Pressman in an employment context where there was an employee at will. I'm fairly certain that the holding was that, yes, generally an employee at will can't complain about being terminated because, after all, they had no expectation of continuing. On the other hand, if the termination was wrongful, then there is a claim for damages, notwithstanding the fact that the employee had no term contract. By analogy, if I understand Empire's position, what they're saying is that the bank would not have transferred its accounts but for the wrongful conduct and the conspiracy, the theft and the conspiracy to commit the theft and enter into the new relationship, because it would not have been in the bank's best interest to abandon its relationship with Empire. Therefore, the 7-day notice provision is irrelevant because, but for the wrongful conduct, it is reasonable to expect that the relationship would have continued for some extended period of time into the future, just as it had continued for 10 years in the past. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, I think, if I recall the Pressman case, it's a case that says the covenant of good faith and fair dealing can apply to an at-will employment contract. So I think that's the framework in which that was decided, if I'm not mistaken. I believe, Justice Berger, what's wrong with that analysis is two things. One, the bank had good and sufficient reason for moving the accounts even after 10 years of a good relationship with Empire. Number one, it was selling off its charged-off accounts. It was putting them in packages and securitizing them and selling them. Secondly, four collectors out of Empire's five collectors left the company and went to the new agency for reasons of their own. And, for example, the trial record showed that Mr. Ocasio wanted to own a larger percentage of Empire. He was a 25% owner, and the principal owner refused. The trial record showed that Mr. Ocasio thought that the principal owner of Empire was taking Empire funds and diverting them to another of his businesses. So Ocasio had reasons having nothing to do with the bank for going to the new agency. The other three collectors left with him, leaving essentially no collection staff. So the bank had good and sufficient reason.
Well, wait a second. That's all after the theft, right? I mean, Ocasio and his cohorts set up a new company with records that they weren't entitled to have. So the fact that after that's done, the bank says, oh, well, Empire really doesn't have much left of a staff, and we're going to go with this new outfit. Isn't that putting the rabbit in the hat?
Well, I don't think so, because the record showed that the letter terminating Empire was sent before these collectors had left. And that's really my answer.
Mr. Grant, I just want to pick up on Justice Berger's question and ask it in a slightly different way. If Empire's claim had been that by withdrawing the accounts, the bank had somehow breached its contract with Empire, then one would assume that the seven-day limitation on damages, which is a contract limitation, could be used as a defense, even
Correct.
If there were some liability. But the claim here doesn't arise in contract. It arises in tort.
Right.
It may be that under the contract, the bank could have withdrawn its accounts and would be liable only for 7 days worth of receipts. But that contract right doesn't privilege the bank to engage in a tortious conspiracy.
True.
And that being the case, why, as a matter of tort law, should this contract damage limitation be a defense at all? Why should it be relevant when we're in the world of tort and not contract?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's relevant, Justice Jacobs, because the purpose of the tort law is to put the plaintiff in the position he would have been in if no tort had occurred. If we go back to what I just said about the law of damages under civil conspiracy, which is the damages you're entitled to are those arising from the wrongful or tortious overt act. The wrongfulness of that act, we submit, is measured by Empire's contract rights. In other words, at any time, Empire was at risk of losing the accounts and having the right to 7 days' worth of collections. When the paper is stolen, when the records are stolen by Ocasio, the question to ask is, what tort damages does Empire get from that theft? And we say the tort damages are bounded by the bank's contractual right to pull the accounts at any time, so the records could only serve a purpose for the next 7 days.
Ocasio wouldn't be limited. His liability for damages wouldn't be limited by that seven-day provision, would it?
He's not a party to that contract.
Correct.
Right.
And if the bank is properly found to be in conspiracy with Ocasio to commit that tort, then isn't the bank jointly and severally liable for whatever damages Ocasio would be liable for, Ocasio being the person who committed the overt act?
Well, jointly and severally, yes. That's the purpose of conspiracy law.
In which case, the seven-day provision falls out.
No, I don't think so, Justice Jacobs. I disagree with that because Empire's rights, regardless of who took the paper, are to keep the accounts for 7 days. It's always at risk of losing the accounts on 7 days' notice. So I think the question that you should be asking is, all right, if Empire had the collection records stolen by somebody, for how long could it have used those records to generate profits? And the answer is, it had no expectancy that it could keep those records for more than 7 days. So as to I think the measure would probably be the same as against Ocasio as against the bank, because I haven't thought about it. But
you're changing your answer to my first question.
I am.
You're saying that Ocasio could use the seven-day provision of a contract to which he was not a party as a limitation on damages?
I think he probably could. Yeah, I am changing my answer. But certainly the bank can.
Is there any significance to the fact, if it is a fact, that Ocasio settled with Empire?
Well, we think, I don't, Chief Justice, if you're asking about a damages issue, I'm not sure I directly see the pertinence. I mean, we've raised his settlement in discussing the fact that he has no incentive or no disincentive to be honest about whether there was an agreement. I'm not quite sure I see the damages-related issue unless...
Was there a release?
There was a release which did not release Empire's claims against the bank. Let me just speak briefly about the zero damages ruling. Everything about that ruling is procedural context. That's our submission. Empire had years to prove its damages. Empire submitted multiple damages reports from a couple of different experts because the first became ill, which had a lost profits measure of damages. And what Empire did was say, look at the accounts that we categorize as paying and legal. Look at the revenues that our expert says would have been generated over a four-year period. Look at the costs that would have been incurred in generating them. The difference is our lost profits. Those profits, if Empire had kept the accounts as it said it should have, would have been received after the seven-day period. So that was the gist of our summary judgment motion on damages. The Superior Court agreed with us and said to Empire, you can have the seven-day period. However, it's undisputed that Empire was paid in full whatever commissions it was entitled to for receipts during that seven-day period. So if you have any other damages in the seven-day period, give the bank a report, tell them what the damages are. It never did that. The court set a deadline. Empire just ignored the deadline. And it's our submission that the court was well within its discretion in saying that Empire had failed to prove the measure of damages, had ignored a court order setting a deadline, and therefore ordering zero damages.
That's assuming that the measure of damages that the court insisted upon was correct.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
You going to reserve the rest of your time?
I shall. Thank you.
Your Honor, in focusing on what the trial judge did hold in limiting Empire to 7 days worth of damages, that's what Empire was arguably entitled to under the contract, under the court's interpretation of the contract. That means that the court awarded zero damages for the civil conspiracy. Now, and that basically guts the law of civil conspiracy. There has to be a reason why we have that concept. And I think Justice Ridgely aptly stated why we have it, to increase the measure of damages. The bank would not have withdrawn those accounts because Empire
to increase the measure of damages or to increase the number of people who were.
It says the measure. It says the measure of damages, Your Honor. Your Honor, as a practical matter, they would not have withdrawn the accounts but for the illegal conduct. There was an economic balance of power. Arguably, they had the right to withdraw the accounts under the contract, but as a practical matter, they would have to start from scratch if they'd done so. Find out where these people lived, find out where they worked, develop agreements with them and so forth. They would have clearly suffered an enormous economic loss had they done it.
We just heard the exact opposite from your colleague.
Beg your pardon?
We just heard the exact opposite from your colleague, that there were at least three other reasons why the bank would have withdrawn the accounts, unrelated to this theft of documents. Are those all factually inaccurate?
I believe they are, Your Honor. I mean, as far as selling off the charged-off accounts, as of 2004, they were still receiving payments directly from accounts that had been removed. Now, I'm not sure which accounts they sold off, but it's factually accurate that they were still receiving money on accounts that had been taken back in 1997 in 2004. They may have sold something off, but there's at least one account out there that he didn't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The rebuttal time that I had reserved related to my cross-appeal, and Mr. Radelsky didn't say anything further, so I don't have anything to add relative to the cross-appeal where we raise the issue of whether an agreement exists.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.